Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How historic is the nomination of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to the U.S. Supreme Court? What impact will having a former criminal defense attorney on the Supreme Court have on future rulings or on dissents? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. President Joseph Biden made history with his nomination of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to replace Stephen Breyer as an associate justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. If confirmed, she will be the first African-American woman to serve on the court. Along with an impressive resume, she also has a background as a criminal defense attorney. This is rare for the modern Supreme Court. On today's show, we will explore the historic development in her nomination, and in particular discuss the impact of representing criminal defense approaches to the law on the Supreme Court. Our panel is Abby Smith, director of the Criminal Defense and Prisoner Advocacy Clinic and professor of law at Georgetown University. She is the author of Guilty People and Beyond the Rodney King Story, an investigation of police conduct in minority communities. Danielle Holly Walker. She is the dean and professor of law at Howard University School of Law. She is the author of A New Era for Desegregation and After Unitary Status, Examining Voluntary Integration Strategies for Southern School Districts. And Olu Orange, director of the University of Southern California's Dornsife Trial Advocacy Program, and also director of USC Dornsife's Agents of Change Civil Rights Advocacy Initiative. As a practicing attorney, he's won several important cases. I'll cite one here, B.B. Burley versus County of Los Angeles, which was a knee-on-neck police death case, which established that police officers who intentionally cause harm cannot offset their liability with their victim's negligence. The case has been referred to as George Floyd without video. Thank you all for joining us. Danielle Holly Walker, I'll ask you first, the description of this nomination, it's always described as historic. What exactly is sort of the most historic, the most representative, you know, of the historic nature of this nomination, both politically for questions of representation and also just approaches to law?
Thanks so much for having me today, and I'm looking forward to this conversation. Obviously, the historic nature of the nomination has been that Judge Jackson, if confirmed, will be the first Black woman ever to serve on the Supreme Court. Supreme Court's been around for 230 plus years, 115 justices, and we've never had a Black woman on the court. So that is an incredibly important moment. I think especially when we know that courts are important in terms of representation and feeling confidence in what our court system does. And many people feel that the courts do not represent them. And we know that in terms of population, African-Americans, our Latinx population are severely underrepresented in the federal judiciary. And so this becomes an incredibly important moment for showing that Black women who make up about 2% of the legal profession are finally having the doors of opportunity open to them at the highest level of the profession, including the Supreme Court.
And Abby Smith, is there an expectation that she might approach the law differently or have different insights in interpretation of the law, you know, based on her life experiences?
I hope so. I think so. Few sites were more moving in recent years than the press conference at which President Biden announced his nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court. On either side of him was a woman of color, Vice President Harris and KBJ, Ketanji Brown Jackson. I just thought it was just such a great sight. You know, the only thing that could compare was the State of the Union address at which he was surrounded by Nancy Pelosi and Kamala Harris. Sonia Sotomayor was given a lot of grief for saying that she believed she brought the wisdom of a Latina woman with her life experience to the court. And I think she was right. One of the things that any of us who have ever practiced law in front of a jury know is the most important thing about fact finders is their life experience. There's not just one truth out there in the world. And, you know, I'm hoping that her life experience as a public defender, as an African-American woman, as a person who has members of law enforcement in her family, as a person who had an uncle who served a substantial prison sentence, that all of those things will inform her judgment as they should. I think it's promising that she comes with the experience she comes with. Now, let me just point out, she was only a public defender for a couple and a half years. And it was a federal defender job, not a state defender job. State defender jobs are where all the street crime is. It's not surprising, I suppose, that some of the Republican interrogators focused on child pornography, because that's a federal offense. And relatively speaking, compared to state courts, you don't find so much so-called violent crime. And I call it so-called because it runs the gamut from drug dealing to burglary to robbery to homicide. But I'm hoping she brings her life experience to the fore. I'm hoping the couple and a half years that she was a public defender and the time she spent at that kind of big law firm doing Guantanamo defense, I'm hoping that will inform her judgment as well. Because here's the thing about the law. It does not exist in a vacuum. It touches people's lives directly. And I think one of the challenges for this country at this point in history is that we stand alone when it comes to incarcerating our own people. Something has to change. There seemed to be a movement afoot for a minute where the right and the left were coming together, you know, out of fiscal concerns and also, frankly, as a matter of morality. It can't be a society in which you banish people until old age.
Olu Orange, I mean, obviously this is a historic nomination as the first African-American woman, but it's actually, again, just the third Black justice in history is also really, that in and of itself is quite striking, that's questions about representation. Certainly the court's been awfully white throughout its history. So I guess ultimately, do you think she brings? What kind of experience, what kind of life experiences, what kind of professional experiences, does she bring that's going to be unique or more progressive for the court?
I think what she brings that's unique is a perspective on the practice of law that involves people, primarily people. As Abby was pointing out, most law that you hear of judges practicing in their former days when they were practitioners involves issues, involves finances, involves something tied to money or business, but very rarely involves anything tied to people. And not only does she have the perspective on the practice of law that involves people, but she also has had an opportunity to see how precedent affects people as it filters down through the appellate level and then down through the trial court level, because she's been a judge at all levels. And I think that perspective is extraordinarily important, because in its most basic end, in its most important function, what law does is impact the lives of people.
And Danielle, when hearing this, one case that immediately comes to mind is the famous Miranda case. The focus of the court in that case was as much on the impact of certain police interrogation practices on defendants as it was broadly sort of, some existential constitutional question. I mean, is this the sort of example that we may expect to see, her raising? That, I mean, there is the broad questions, and she certainly can manage those quite effectively. But these decisions, Supreme Court decisions, are meant to alter practices that improve the lives of the people who have this impact, the police, the judiciary, et cetera.
I think, yeah, absolutely. One thing, I'll go back to something that Abby just said that, really makes a big difference in terms of her experience. We've seen it with Justice Sotomayor. I think in so many places, whether it's voting rights cases or some of the criminal cases, criminal procedural cases, often Justice Sotomayor will write dissents that literally go to the lives of everyday people and talk very carefully about the, you know, and a lot of it has been in the shadow docket where these are not, you know, published opinions that the Supreme Court will write, but Justice Sotomayor will say, look, this is how this opinion will impact the lives of everyday people negatively. And I do expect that Judge Jackson will be someone who will have a similar take in terms of her position on cases, but also the way she writes opinions. It's interesting that when people say, well, she's, what impact will she really have? Because we're talking about a 6-3 court. I think the impact is some of our most influential Supreme Court justices have been dissenters. So when we think of people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, when we think of Justice Thurgood Marshall, graduated from Howard's Law School, we think of them because of them standing up to these forces that they disagreed with and felt like were harmful to their communities, even when they were Supreme Court justices, right? Just because they weren't in the majority didn't mean that they weren't influential. And I'll take one more case. So you mentioned Miranda, but look at Loving versus Virginia. So this week, when senators have been asking her all about substantive due process rights, they're really going to the heart of the abortion cases and asking her whether she would be willing to undermine cases like Griswold and Roe. But what they're also asking is about our most, you know, basic rights, like a right to marry who we want to, regardless of race, and the government interfering with that. And in her own life, she could see that if, you know, some of the things that they're talking about rolling back would mean she, in some states, she wouldn't be able to marry her husband. And I think we saw that there were commentators this week, including a sitting senator, who said we should leave to the states things like whether you can interracially marry. It is hard to believe that in 2022, we've come to the place where we have a sitting senator who suggests that it would be constitutional under the United States Constitution to stop someone from marrying someone else because of their race. But that's where we are. And that's where some of the Republican senators were trying to ask her to go this week.
Yeah, that, and thinking challenges to Griswold versus Connecticut, the choice of a married couple being able to use contraception. I found myself thinking, I thought when I learned those cases back in as undergrads that those, you know, were historical cases and not necessarily contemporary ones.
I want to kind of underscore or be an amen chorus to something Professor Orange said about the practice of law and how that's become a rarefied, you know, experience for members of our highest court. I think that's really troubling. We rely, frankly, on Justice Sotomayor to be the voice of somebody who's had some experience with actual people and the way the law, and in particular the criminal law, affects actual people. And she was a prosecutor, you know, but she at least labored in a big urban courthouse. She was a Manhattan, she was, you know, an assistant district attorney at the Manhattan DA's office, and she experienced law at its most coercive, at its most violent. And also she saw the disproportionate impact that our law, and especially the criminal law, has on Black and Brown people. And that's a really important experience. And I agree with Dean Holly Walker, you know, her dissents have been downright lyrical sometimes. In the case of Utah versus Strife, which involved a police stop where there was no probable cause or reasonable suspicion, but the U.S. Supreme Court held that a person could be detained long enough for the police to discover whether there are any outstanding warrants for their arrest, including traffic warrants. Sonia Sotomayor's dissent is, I hope every law school in the country teaches it, because, you know, not only does she speak truth to power, as it were, she talks about what it's like to live in a society where people are under so much surveillance for absurd things. But she also had the guts to cite people like James Baldwin and Ta-Nehisi Coates in making the point about the impact that law has on regular people. So, boy, my hope is that Justice Sotomayor takes Justice Brown Jackson under her wing, and that the two of them together are a force to be reckoned with.
You're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the nomination of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson and the impact it will have on the Supreme Court and on the rule of law in the U.S. Our guests are Abby Smith of Georgetown University, Danielle Holly Walker of Howard University School of Law, and Olu Orange of the University of Southern California. Olu, you had a response to that as well.
Yes, I just wanted to jump in with a quick thought about the importance of dissents, even though you know, there's not a majority for the positions, many of the positions that Justice Sotomayor has, and that I would expect that in some cases Justice Jackson would have. Oftentimes, the decisions that come down from the Supreme Court are in some ways practically unworkable. And so what happens is that appellate courts, circuit courts of appeals, look at the dissents, as well as practitioners, look at the dissents to try to figure out how to make things work. And so those dissents can be very, very important as far as implementation. They can also be very, very important for when the issue comes up again and you want to try to argue for a different approach to the issue. The dissents sometimes lay out what the next position of the court will be.
Olu, I want to follow this up too, because there's been a tendency recently that nominees to the Supreme Court haven't necessarily been practicing attorneys in the past. So even though it was, what, a little over 2 years that she was a practicing criminal defense attorney, she's been in the courtroom, you know, been at the table, you know, as well as being a judge. How important is that, that we have justices on that court that say, you know, these rulings are going to have to be interpreted and they're going to have an impact on the actual court proceedings? And so when you're saying there's these examples where they can't figure out, you know, how to actually implement it, is part of that because many of them just really haven't been in a courtroom?
I think so. Quite honestly, I really believe that, for example, if you look at a lot of the cases on qualified immunity and the rulings on qualified immunity, and then you consider the fact that, for example, the mismatch between warrant affidavits and actually the warrants that, you know, come out of Messerschmidt versus Millender and cases like that. And you think about the fact that these officers, with the support, I will say, of Supreme Court precedent, are walking away from situations where they're stealing money out of the evidence locker because, you know, no one has stolen money out of the evidence locker before or in a way that puts them on notice that doing so would be wrong. It's just ridiculous. And I think that the people who are charged with making decisions and handing down precedent on issues need to have a better understanding of exactly what it supports and allows people to do and what it prevents people from doing. They don't have that understanding.
Abby Smith, your thoughts.
If you only have appellate experience, which has increasingly been the norm, and I agree with Professor Orange, usually preceded by corporate law experience or something kind of rarefied and abstract where all you're doing is grappling with legal arguments, you just don't know. You don't know how policing works. And I like it as well that Judge Brown Jackson was a trial court judge in the federal district court. She saw litigants, she saw actual people. And in an age of police body-worn cameras, she also knows, both from her experience as a public defender and from being a trial court judge, what policing looks like. You know, you can make it sound as antiseptic as you'd like, a stop and frisk, an arrest. They're pretty brutal encounters between the police and citizens. Oftentimes, in my experience, and I've been a criminal defense lawyer for almost 40 years, for no reason at all, except for the neighborhood in which a person resides, color of their skin, their gender, and the fact that they have pals that they're hanging out with on a street corner. And I just think that's really important. And we've lost our ability to see, you know, how law actually works. I had this fantasy when Hillary was running for president that she would put Brian Stevenson on the Supreme Court. And at last, a number of hideous decisions would be overturned. Terry versus Ohio, Wardlaw versus Illinois. Oh, there are a couple of others too. Wren. You know, all these cases that, you know, Wren is a case that says that police are allowed to stop a person for pretextual reasons, so long as they can come up with a lawful reason. I mean, those cases are really, they're just race-based policing, you know, hidden by other language.
Danielle, you were going to respond as well.
I think one of the other interesting comparisons, again, is that the other justice who has trial experience as a trial judge is Justice Sotomayor. I think when we're thinking about who is Justice Jackson probably most likely to be like, that's another indication. But I thought one of the most interesting points of the confirmation hearing this week was hearing senators criticize her for some of those real life interactions, right? So the things that trial judges do, when she had to explain to a senator, I think it was Senator Hawley, you know, when I sentence someone, it's important for me to explain to them because they are losing their freedom, why I'm sentencing them the way that I am. I explained the sentencing guidelines, but it was the kind of line of questioning of someone who has never practiced law, really, it doesn't really understand what trial judges do, right? She wasn't an appellate court judge kind of sitting antiseptically away from the cases in the litigants that she's dealing with. But instead, when you have a criminal defendant right there in front of you, and this is very common too among federal district court judges, to take some time to explain to defendants why they're being sentenced, what parts of the sentencing guidelines are being used, what parts of their of the probation report were used in the determination of the sentencing. But I think her experience as a trial court judge will be critical in the criminal law cases and in lots of other cases for her to make decisions that really show how the law impacts the lives of everyday people.
I like the way she talked about sentencing. And I think Sonia Sotomayor shares that feeling. It's a moment of tragedy. And, you know, she got accused of feeling sorry for people who are convicted of crime. But of course, at a sentencing, you know, it is tragic. One of my favorite former federal prosecutors said when he was a prosecutor, he hated sentencings because he realized he had a role to play in depriving somebody of liberty. And there's sad occasions. And I love the way she talked about it in response to some pretty hard questions. And it showed her ability to remain humble and human, notwithstanding the number of cases she's undoubtedly, you know, presided over.
You know, the other thing too, what about the kids and the parents and the family members of the persons who are sentenced? They're there. They are often there. And when some child sees his father, mother, uncle, whomever, taken away in cuffs by these officers, they deserve an explanation, as does some parent. It makes no sense with the way that she was being questioned and the questions that she was getting thrown at her and the underlying presumptions behind those questions.
The dehumanization, I think this is what, when you said Brian Stevenson, you know, this notion that none of us are the worst thing we've ever done and that people are still human when they're convicted of crime. It's remarkable that in our public discourse, we have to have someone remind a group of sitting senators that someone who's convicted of a crime is still a human being and deserves to be treated with humanity. And it's okay to have feelings about those people and to try to help their families and the defendant understand what's happening. None of that should be unusual in our system.
Dean Holly Walker, you got me thinking about one line of questioning. The way it was raised was kind of bizarre. The critical race theory question that was raised, Ibram X. Kendi book in the school, but a bit of a shame that we can't publicly in a hearing like this have this conversation about the way in which the law has different impacts on race. Kind of broadly, that conversation that we should be having about the law's impact on different races, there's this assumption that the Supreme Court should just make decisions based on some legal principle and not take those kinds of questions into account. And in particular, as a dean of a law school, how do you integrate that obvious question about the law, those different impacts, while still recognizing that, you know, law is based on principle and at least the image is Lady Liberty is supposed to be blind.
Yeah. I'll say first about our law school, just that the entire premise of Howard's Law School, obviously, is that there is no discussion of law without talking about race. And that we are deeply committed to racial justice and social justice as being the mission of our law school. So we always talk about it. I think what was interesting was when Ted Cruz asked her on the first day of questioning about critical race theory, there was no connection that he ever attempted to draw between her work as a sitting judge or her work as potentially a Supreme Court justice in the questions he was asking. He did not even attempt to draw a connection, which means it was not about her being a sitting judge or a Supreme Court justice. This was the portion of the hearing, which a lot of it, unfortunately, it was disgraceful, that so much of the hearing were just midterm talking points. And the political theater of asking about critical race theory. I'm happy to say that Anti-Racist Baby, which I also bought a few copies of, is back on the bestsellers list. But I think how troubling it is to ask an African-American woman whether you agree with random views of other Black people. He asked her literally, do you agree with Nicole Hannah Jones? Do you agree with Ibram Kendi? The only thing that she has in common with any of those people is that they are Black and she's Black. They've written books. He didn't even try to draw a connection between them in terms of schools, lines of thought. It would be different if she had some association. Judge Jackson has no association with Ibram Kendi or Nicole Hannah Jones, and it was in every way a racist line of questioning. And to say it was racially charged or it was racially tinged or any of that is not sufficient. I never saw Justice Barrett asked or Justice Gorsuch asked about, do they believe in random people who write about law and economics? They're conservatives. They weren't asked any of those things. So it was, we should not mistake that this moment was one of the most shameful moments that we have seen in confirmation hearings.
You're right to point out it was embarrassing because Judge Brown Jackson is not a protege of Derrick Bell. She's not best friends with Kimberly Crenshaw. But how about Ted Cruz quoting Martin Luther King to Ketanji Brown Jackson? Honest to God, I've never seen people sink so low. And they had bragged about how these hearings were going to be incredibly respectful.
Yeah, and by the way, drawing from Danielle's example, it's rather like just asking any white judge their opinion about any random white author. The only reason why you're asking is because of race. It's such a ridiculous line of questioning.
You know, she's a Stephen Breyer protege.
Mm-hmm.
He is not a left-wing justice. He's a very moderate liberal. He's very considered and cares. It wasn't surprising that she talked about judicial method because that's what Breyer is all about. And he's a white guy. Why didn't they talk about him?
In contrast, I think Senator Sasse asked her what were appropriate questions in this realm, right? Because he asked her, what do you think of the book that Justice Breyer and Justice Scalia wrote together when they went on tour together and talked about their philosophies? Those were all appropriate questions. And he drew a line. Why is he asking her about Justice Scalia? Because he's asking her about judicial philosophy and about the justice she clerked for. But to ask about random Black authors, was just beyond anything that I thought we would actually see. It was worse than I imagined. And I imagined a lot of terrible things, and it was bad.
But weren't you so proud of Cory Booker? I've never loved him more. I thought he was wonderful.
It was interesting that, and I'm sure Olu has had many of the same experiences of how, I think what happened is that I got so many text messages from Black women and men all over the country who said, I've been subjected to the same kind of treatment in my own workplace. And there's hopefully someone in your workplace who will lift you up and say, forget about what all these other people are saying, you belong here. And that's the experience that I had watching it was just, oh my gosh, I think of the number of days when I was the first Black woman on a law faculty in the year 2005, how many days I had where I went home demoralized. And then there were people in the space who lifted me up. And that's what he did for her on that day. And it meant more than just about the two of them. It meant something about Black people and people of color in spaces all around our country and workplaces all around our country. And that's why I think it hit such a point, because women have been there, people of color, people of LGBTQIA background have all had that moment where they feel alone and someone comes along and says, you're not alone, I'm standing here with you.
When we come back, what impact will having a former criminal defense attorney on the Supreme Court have on future rulings or on dissents? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson is a former public defender. And when confirmed, she will be the first Supreme Court justice with a background as a public defender. What does this mean for her potential decisions? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Our panel today is Abby Smith of Georgetown University, Danielle Holly Walker of Howard University's School of Law, and Olu Orange of the University of Southern California. And Olu, I'll direct this question initially at you. We keep hearing that we haven't had a justice who had worked as a criminal defense attorney on the court since Thurgood Marshall. So it's pretty rare that we've had, you know, defense attorneys on the court. So why is that? And what does that mean, you know, for the court broadly, that that's just not a path that seems to lead to the Supreme Court?
You know, I once had a conversation with Justice Kennedy, and I made the assumption that he had been a prosecutor. And he corrected me and told me that he was actually a criminal defense attorney, that he did Criminal Justice Act cases and handled indigent criminal defense matters for clients, and that experience actually informed a lot of the positions that people were surprised that he took. And so I think that having another justice on the court with criminal defense experience can only be a good thing, because criminal defenders end up actually having contact with people and having to deal with all of the personal, family, financial, every kind of issue you can think that a person has, criminal defender has to deal with that in the context often of handling their case. And so I think exposure to those matters is a wonderful thing for a judge to have in her background.
And Abby Smith, I know that the court has a recent trend towards, you know, finding broadly when police are accused of misconduct, finding on behalf of the police, and that when there's any form of misconduct, that not being disqualifying of a prosecution. So I think it's fair to say that the court has clearly tipped its scales in favor of prosecution. How much is it tipped in favor of prosecution? And how much is having somebody who's worked as a criminal defense attorney offer some hope that they might tip at least a little bit back in the other direction?
So it's hard to tell. I mean, for those of us who practice law, we've been both gratified and disappointed by practicing criminal defense lawyers who become judges. Sometimes they're terrific. Sometimes I think perhaps they were burned out criminal defense lawyers and they bring a certain cynicism. And I've been pleasantly surprised by some former prosecutors who have ascended to the bench. And yet there are some other former prosecutors who feel like they're still prosecutors. They're just wearing black robes and deciding cases. But I have high hopes for Judge Jackson, you know, partly because I thought she was magnificent throughout the hearings. Boy, she was made of steel. And I think that criminal defense lawyers have special knowledge about two things, about what Professor Orange so eloquently describes about our clients, their family members, their loved ones. But also, I think we have a really vivid experience of what it means to face enormous government power, and that it's not an abstraction in a criminal proceeding. It really is you, the defense lawyer, and your client against just an army of resources and also public opinion. And I agree with Dean Holly Walker that, you know, the midterm elections seem like they were front and center for Republicans because there was such a focus on rising crime, which is such an old Republican trope, to try to scare their base to vote and try to scare independents. You know, good people do bad things. And you know how there's that saying that a conservative is a liberal who's been mugged? Well, I think a liberal on criminal justice is a conservative who's had a family member or a loved one get caught up in the criminal legal system and has experienced how horrible it can be.
And Danielle Holly Walker, are you expecting more of a tip back towards the defendant rights? Because that certainly was marked when Justice Thurgood Marshall was on the court. One of the lasting legacies was a recognition of criminal rights, but it seems like the court since his death has really gone pretty hard in the other direction. So could this be a rebalancing?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that Judge Jackson and herself will be able to rebalance the court in that way. But I think what she will be able to do is similar to what we've heard about stories about Justice Marshall, which when you hear people like Justice O'Connor and others talk about their experience with Justice Marshall, what they said is he often brought a voice into the room that wasn't there and a sense of how the real world works, but also being able to build consensus and influence. And I think one thing that we heard from some of the conservative judges and others who had worked on with her on the sentencing commission was she was someone who was able to really persuade other people and talk to them about the variety of life experience that she's had. I think it really is important, as Olu said, that she has not just people who've been in law enforcement, but also people who are close to her, her uncle who actually served a long prison sentence. And so from that, I think, yes, there's no doubt to me that she will be able to have some influence on cases. Now, will it be a complete, you know, turnabout for, you know, these justices and the way they handle? No. I think we're still going to see, we're in the midst of one of the most regressive eras in Supreme Court history. And I think it will continue to be that way. I think what she can do is maybe lessen, some of the load or maybe how bad some of the outcomes are, but I don't expect that she will be able to kind of completely change the course of what we're seeing. This is a fast moving train that's going to some terrible places. And unfortunately, she's going to be there during this part of the Supreme Court's history.
But Douglas, I hate to pick on you, but let's not call them criminal rights. We're talking about constitutional rights. They're all of our rights. And they're incredibly important, and they happen to live most vividly in criminal cases. But, you know, some justices who are not themselves criminal defense lawyers seem to understand that, whether it was Justice Douglas or Justice Brennan. The laws that protect the rights of the individual against the government are not technicalities. They are fundamental rights.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And Olu, I know you've worked on cases that were really directed more towards the policing practices, much more of an institutional question. Of course, this gets framed as the rights of criminal defendants, but in many ways, I mean, fighting for criminal defendant rights or advocating for criminal defendant rights are really about changing institutional practices, right?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, you know, when I was a public defender, I was a public defender just a bit south of Los Angeles in Orange County, which is an ultra conservative county here in California. And what I found is exactly what Ab said. And that is that the rights are constitutional rights. And so it is you, your client, and the Constitution standing against the sixth largest economy of scale on the planet has come for your client on that day, and you've got to do something about it. And so making the connection between the people, the jurors, who are hearing the case and the fact that the rights that are at issue are their rights, as well as the rights of the person whose fate they are considering, is crucial. And in addition to that, you know, when you make the jump into the police practices side, that same Constitution is what underpins and governs the police practices. And so they are supposed to be adherent to what the dictates are that were set forth constitutionally. And they aren't oftentimes. And so having a justice who understands that and understands where things separate, how they go wrong, how to fix them, is crucial. And I think that that Judge Jackson be that justice.
So, Dean Holly Walker, what areas do you imagine could be the could be some that a new Justice Jackson would have the greatest impact, especially considering, as I said, no matter what happens, it's still going to be a majority 6-3 court. But do you see any potential openings there where a confirmation of Justice Jackson could have an immediate impact? Or is this a waiting game to wait to replace some of the 6 conservative justices with less conservative ones?
I think it's really important for your audience to remember that many of the cases that the Supreme Court decides every year are not the high profile, you know, 5-4, 6-3 cases. And many of those are still very important cases. So I think that's where she may have a lot of influence. I'm thinking particularly in the realm that I teach and write in, which is in administrative law, where there are a lot of current questions about interpretation of statutes that help form our administrative agency and questions about how the administrative state works. These questions are very important to the everyday lives of American people, of the American people. Often they fly below the radar in terms of what we talk about in the popular space, but we have some justices, including Justice Gorsuch, who have pretty strong views that are outside of what our current precedents are in those areas. And I think Judge Jackson is a trial judge in DC and now on the DC circuit has a very well-developed, and we saw that on display when she was talking so much about separation of powers in the area of sentencing. I think she could be hugely influential in the legislation, regulation, administrative law area, which is a critical area that the Supreme Court takes many cases on each year.
And Abby Smith, they never really got into the questions about judicial approaches, you know, judicial philosophy, but actually they did. And that was one thing that I found striking sort of at two levels. One, she actually gave a pretty conservative response at one point about original intent, but mostly what it sounded like she was saying is you need to read the statute and, you know, read the discourse and then apply the law, you know, on that basis, which I realized at that point that that's the difference between a legal scholar who's thinking abstractly about the law versus somebody who actually has to try to apply the law. Is that a fair, you know, description of the way that she said she was going to approach the law? That, and it's really much more sort of a practical, I've had to approach it because I've had to be a judge, and that's going to be the sensibilities I bring to the court.
I mean, I think all nominees to the Supreme Court have learned how to duck and cover when those sorts of questions are asked. And, you know, Chief Justice Roberts famously likened himself to a baseball umpire. What I got from the way she answered questions, especially some of the hard questions about her sentencing decisions, is that she used the word context a lot. And I actually like that she's not narrowly, rigidly applying the law to facts, but she's considering the individual case before her with all of the individual actors. I frankly found it kind of moving when she talked about sentencing defendants convicted of child pornography, that she makes a point of explaining to them that even though they probably didn't have this in mind, there's a young woman out there who feels that photos of her that were taken when she was a child in the most exploitive, coercive way are still harming her. I just thought that was a beautiful example of context and of being respectful to the offender and deeply respectful to, you know, about victims of crime. I don't know, I thought she handled that beautifully. And I think it's a great thing that both in private practice and as a federal defender, she worked on Guantanamo cases. That, you know, I'm surprised nobody mentioned John Adams, who, you know, called the proudest moment of his professional career his representation of the Redcoats in the Boston Tea Party, that it's really important to represent the most unpopular among us. And you know, I from what I know, she's never turned down a case. That's the kind of lawyering that I try to teach my students is important. And so I'm really glad that she models that.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the historic nomination of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson and her background, her experience as a criminal defense attorney with Abby Smith of Georgetown University, Danielle Holly Walker of Howard University, and Olu Orange of the University of Southern California. Dean Holly Walker, I know you're going to step out after this, so I want to give you an opportunity to sort of give us a final response. So we spent the last week, we got to know Judge Jackson, you know, quite well. I think there's a consensus on this panel that she was impressive at this point. Are there any broad lessons that you would take from this conversation and the broad political conversation we've been having about the courts as a result? Because whenever there's a nominee, you know, for an associate justice, we start thinking more and more broadly about the courts. Are there broad lessons that you think that might be indicating on the way we should think about the court and maybe the direction that's going?
One thing that was interesting to me, and I was in a board meeting at a civil rights organization with a judge who retired, federal judge who retired, and she said, it's really important that we not normalize what happened in these hearings. What we saw was unacceptable from the Republican senators. It was not civil. It was not respectful. And the truth was, a lot of it was not about the role of the courts. And I think hopefully we will come back to a place. It seems like we're getting further and further afield. And obviously, Supreme Court confirmation hearings have always been political theater. But I think this week took it to new lows. And hopefully we'll see some pullback. On the other side, I will say I've never seen quite a display of sisterhood, which is one of my favorite values. As we saw, we got to see our brilliant colleague, Lisa Fairfax from University of Pennsylvania, introduce her in what I have to say was one of the most moving introductions I've ever seen in a confirmation hearing. And to see the representation of Black women scholars all week, you know, judges, lawyers, heads of organizations, professors on shows and talking about, and just the display of the beauty of our profession, and the need for our profession to be even more diverse than what it is. To me, that's one of the things I will always take away, is that this was a week in which if people had not paid attention to our profession before, they got to see the brilliance of Judge Jackson, a brilliant Black woman, and many other brilliant Black women supporting her over the last week. And that has meant a lot personally to me.
Thank you very much. And I know you need to slip out. And I want to get both of your responses to that same question. So although I'll ask you first, do you have any takeaways from the discourse we've been having about the court, about the role of criminal defense, about the issues that we raised, that we can see potentially a direction that the legal field, maybe the Supreme Court,
absolutely. Should be addressing? As a matter of fact, I think that what will accelerate is something that has been happening already, and it will happen more effectively. And what that is the states will take up a lot of issues themselves that people had previously been looking to the Supreme Court to do something about or to pass on as far as handing down some rule of law. The main one that I'm thinking of, the situations of police misconduct and civil rights. The Supreme Court's position on qualified immunity, an ongoing position on qualified immunity, has prompted, at least in California, a revision of California's state civil rights laws in order to more effectively handle situations of civil rights violations, because the federal causes of action are no longer as effective as people desire them to be, particularly the implementation of increased deference to officers in the qualified immunity standard. And I think that that's going to happen with a lot of other issues too. And my hope is that in the dissents from Justice Jackson, and certainly it has been the case with many of the dissents of Justice Sotomayor, that there is some guidance presented to people who were trying to do things about issues on other fronts in those dissents.
Abby Smith, the same question. What do you expect the direction that we're going?
I'm going to share some very cautious optimism that Justice Jackson will help facilitate a conversation that brings together both sides of the court. Justice Scalia was not bad on Fourth Amendment cases. And that, you know, the Fourth Amendment is all about policing. And frankly, it's all about policing minority communities in particular, since you know, so much law happens in concentrated urban environments. And Justice Scalia seemed to have an understanding about the importance of keeping the state at bay, the importance of individual privacy and autonomy. And maybe, just maybe, Justice Jackson will help facilitate a conversation with Justices Kavanaugh and Gorsuch and Roberts. I don't hold out much hope for the others. And maybe we'll breathe a little bit more life into the Fourth Amendment. There's been a bunch of litigation in various cities about stop and frisk and the damage it does to communities and also to legitimacy of law and respect for law enforcement. And I think that'd be a useful conversation for the court to have with her voice present.
I think, you know, for both of you sort of asked this question that, I mean, there's the legal question, but there's also the big broad political question. And I guess what's going to be the outcome of the confirmation votes? And then how do we read back what the discourses were like? Because one of the things that is striking to me is that Judge Jackson has the highest approval rating of any nominee since Judge Roberts, the Chief Justice, and that for all of the questions that she faced, the political judgment, at least at this point, sure seems to be that sided with her. I don't know if it's because of the remarkable grace and dignity that she was able to carry herself in light of the questions, or if it was just the way in which the questions were framed and the responses of those people. But I guess that question of the expectations of who would be on the court. By the way, I also think part of the reason why she's got such a high number is because of the historic nature.
And because of who she is. I mean, it is true. It's terribly disappointing. It was really a big deal when Sandra Day O'Connor ascended to the U.S. Supreme Court. There was joy in the air. And, you know, it was a big deal when Thurgood Marshall ascended to the court and when Ruth Bader Ginsburg ascended. And you know, that's why I really like what Cory Booker had to say. And although I agree with what's been said, that he was doing what I think people of color have experienced all their lives when they're the only one in the room. He was just kind of reaching out a hand. But it should have been a really joyful thing. We should be proud of ourselves. You know, I think it's going to have enormous impact. Look, I'm hoping that young people who go to law school don't think that the only route to a high court or to whatever ambitions they have is by going into corporate practice or being a prosecutor. I'm hoping that people now realize they can be indigent criminal defense lawyers or legal services lawyers or civil rights lawyers and still be considered for exalted posts. And I think it's been incredibly meaningful to my African-American women students that Ketanji is is going to be on the bench. It seems it's pretty clear that she's going to be on the bench, and it's very powerful. And I get that. I understand that. Mm-hmm. And I wish we could all just be proud and celebrated mm-hmm. as a nation. Why couldn't we all come together mm-hmm. for this one?
And Ola Orange, I'm going to give you the last word on this, because I know you've done work in areas that explicitly have been such an important part of the political discourse since 2020, since the murder of George Floyd. And prior to that, there seemed to be this emerging consensus that there needs to be some punishment. And that I think as a society, we generally at least breathe a sigh of relief when Derek Chauvin was successfully prosecuted and convicted. Are these discourses about the role of criminal defense? How much optimism do you have in the political realm that the conversations that have been ongoing are going to continue and actually start to sway a bit more to say, you know, we really do need to check the power of the state. We really do need to check the power of the police. And if we do that through criminal defense, which is traditionally how we've done it, that's something that should be celebrated.
Well, I'm a bit concerned about the future of the conversation and the viability of it. Because I think that the more instances of police killings there are without officers being held accountable to the same extent you or I would be held accountable if we killed someone, then the more desensitized to it the population becomes. For example, here in Los Angeles, there are police killings so frequently that they don't even make the news anymore. But when you hear about major police killing cases, they're always from somewhere else in the country. And, you know, none of the cases deserve anything other than the most attention because, you know, killings by the government that's supposed to protect you, serve you, are the worst crimes. But when they are so frequent and so frequently people aren't held accountable for them, the consciousness about the need to hold people accountable for them seems to decline. And I think that we're approaching that point now because not enough officers are being prosecuted and held accountable for the murders that they're committing. Derek Chauvin was great, but what about the rest of them?
And a good point to conclude. We've been discussing the historic nomination of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to the U.S. Supreme Court, the role of criminal defense on the court, and the discourses about criminal defense politically and legally within the United States, and some conversation about the potential future of the courts. Our panel today has been Abby Smith, Director of the Criminal Defense and Prisoner Advocacy Clinic and Professor of Law at Georgetown University. She's the author of Guilty People and Beyond the Rodney King Story, an investigation of police conduct in minority communities. Danielle Holly Walker, Dean and Professor of Law at Howard University School of Law. She is the author of A New Era for Desegregation and After Unitary Status, Examining Voluntary Integration Strategies for Southern School Districts. And Olu Orange, the Director of the University of Southern California's Dornsife Trial Advocacy Program and also the Director of the USC Dornsife's Agents of Change Civil Rights Advocacy Initiative. He's won several important cases. Again, B.B. Burley versus County of Los Angeles, a knee-on-neck police death case, which established that police officers who intentionally cause harm cannot offset their own liability with their victim's negligence. The case has been referred to as George Floyd without video. Thank you all very much for joining us and for at least enlightening me quite a bit on these very important issues.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.